Neola Group in East Texas, about halfway between Dallas and Shreveport. I got sober in Dallas, Texas, and I have one of my people I got sober with here today. She flew all the way up here from Tampa, Florida for this. So thank you so much. Before I get into all that, I really want to thank the committee for inviting me here. There are a ton of really good speakers out there that can tell a concise story and do it with entertaining. You're going to get one of them tonight. I had breakfast with him this morning, Matthew. I'm not that guy, and they invited me anyhow, so I really thank the committee because I got to come up here and see a lot of my friends. As a result of the pandemic and being on Zoom, I have a ton of friends up here. Last year, I went through a spiritual study to where we were meeting every week for a year with a bunch of them, and my heart is so full to get to meet those people in person, in addition to the Thursday night people that, I don't know, 3 years now, Mars, we've been doing this, book study, and so I was happy that I was going to get to speak in the morning, and now I wish I wasn't because I need to absorb all these emotions that I'm getting, let me tell you. Because I'm meeting people. I met a sponsee that I've been sponsoring for 5 years, and I just met them 2 days ago in person. So it's incredible. So, yes, I am an active member of my group. I believe that when I introduce myself, I should talk about the things that I'm doing in this program that qualify me for doing this. I have had a profound experience as a result of the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous as they are outlined in the big book, not as they're outlined on the wall or in the 12 and 12. Great supplemental reading. Love it. Supplemental reading is what it is. I need the instructions as they're outlined in this book to recover. The unity side of the triangle, I not only attend meetings, but I do everything I can to understand and practice the 12 traditions in those meetings. I am incapable of understanding and practicing real unity with anybody. My whole life proves that. Alcoholics Anonymous taught me how to do that through the 12 traditions and interacting with you in meetings. And when I do that, meetings take on a whole new meaning. It's no longer for me to go there and share whatever problem I have of the day, but I'm there as the primary purpose of the groups is to carry the message to other alcoholics. That changes. When you go to meetings to give instead of take, it changes your whole program. And that's what I try to do, and I attend anywhere from 4 to 7 meetings a week, in doing that. For the service side of the triangle, something I gave lip service to, my first 2 trips in this program, I was my group's GSR, I was demoted to DCM. I am the DCM for District 42. In Netta 65, which is Northeast Texas area. And last weekend I attended our area assembly where I was the scribe to help prepare our delegate to go to New York for our voice to be heard. If you haven't got to experience that, I strongly encourage you to. You get to be part of ensuring the integrity of this program and this message. What a great opportunity. And that's not me. Me, I'm supposed to be the delegate. I'm the grand poopah. That's who I want to be. But I was just the scribe, and I loved it. I got to be a contributor to someone much more qualified to carry that message and to help them do that. And also for service, as was mentioned, I lead a big book study on Thursday night on Zoom, where we go page by page, word by word with what's written in this book. I learn more than I think anybody else on that call, because I have to continue to be in the book. That's what I do today, to live happy, joyous, and free. I have done that before and decided that, you know what, there's something more. Right? And usually it's outside the rooms of AA, and I pursue that something more, and I get miserable again. And I have to go back to that formula, those three sides of the triangle, and doing everything I can on all three of them. That's the only recipe that I know that works. And for an alcoholic like me, I've got to have that. I had three trips into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. The first was I came in the rooms in April 9th, 2001. And I remember the first meeting I went into there, and I was in a suit and tie because I wanted to show up right. I live in a blue collar town, and everybody in there with jeans and t-shirt, and they asked me if I wanted a big book, and I'm thinking, I'm not supposed to be here. I'm not one of you people. I'm not going to buy your literature for sure. So I said I didn't have any money on me, and this old boy in overalls got up and bought me a big book. And I thought, one, he's trying to show me up. That wasn't cool. Two, this guy's out for something, right? He is out for something. And every time he came around, I held onto my wallet because I knew he was slow playing me. He was slow playing me for something. He still is, about 20 years later. He's yet to come collect. You know, I share that story because, you know, we do a lot of little things like that in AA. And don't forget how important those are, because that planted a seed with me. That was inconceivable to me that people did stuff like that, because I didn't think like that. I thought totally different. I was a con. I'm going to get over on everybody and everything. I lived by the rules of the material world, and I was real good at them. Getting over on people, manipulating people. Whatever I did, if it was an act of kindness, it was to get something out of you. And that man, with that simple act, got planted a seed that grew over the years. 4 days shy of a year, I come up to your fine neck of the woods to see a Marine Corps buddy in Coeur d'Alene. And we go over to, what was it called? Fightin' Crick. Anybody know where Fightin' Crick was in Coeur d'Alene? It's gone now. It was a dive bar. And I'm with a Marine Corps buddy. I'm not spiritually sound. My AA at the time was a very meeting-based program, and I didn't have much time before the meeting or after the meeting. And I wasn't going to buy into your God concept. And usually I was doing other things outside the rooms, which prevented a spiritual experience. And I go to this bar with him, and he says he offers me a beer. I'm like, no, I'm not drinking. And then he starts talking about this Kokanee beer, whatever it's called, yeah, the local beer you guys got. And I'm like, well, maybe that's the alcohol that's going to enable me to be able to enjoy and control my alcohol. So 4 days shy of a year, this is where I slipped. 4 hours later, I was passed out on his kitchen table. So I don't think. He didn't offer me a beer yesterday when we hung out. He didn't offer me a beer. When I told him I don't drink, he didn't say anything about that this time around. So I grew up in northern Florida, around the southern Alabama line. All my people are from that area. Dirt poor. I always was ashamed of being so poor, and by the time I was 8 years old, my mother had me going to shrinks because something wasn't right with Dennis. My dad was married 7 times and wasn't around. My mother was a bipolar, extreme. I had three older sisters who all had their own mental illnesses. So, I mean, it was just total chaos when I was growing up. And at about 13 years old, Danny Cook and I stole a beer out of his dad's cooler and ran off, and he drank a sip of it, gave it to me, and I drank the rest of it. And I found the magic potion that fixed me. It was a spiritual experience, as great as the experience was that I got out of the steps. I'm telling you, it was unbelievable how great it was. I had found a treasure that day. And it was about that time. I wasn't one that started drinking alcoholically at the beginning, but I know I loved alcohol. What it did for me was incredible. it solved everything that was going on inside of me. About that time, I was hitting puberty, and I was starting to have a lot of physical altercations with people. I didn't know how to express my emotions. To say I had trouble with personal relationships was an understatement. And soon after that, that came out with fighting. I'm not a fighter at this time. I mean, when I graduated high school, I was 135 pounds. But boy, was I ready to. By the time I was 15 years old, I had gotten into an altercation and done quite a bit of damage. And I was either to go to jail or to move to my mother, in Texas, and that's how I wound up in Texas. By the time I was 17, I joined the Marine Corps, because if you like to fight, that's a good place to be, and they like to drink too, so it fit perfectly for me. About 2 years later, about a year later, I was living in southern Spain, and the girls I was dating at the time got herself pregnant, and since she was only dating me, we talked about this over breakfast, actually. I wasn't the only one that used those phrases. She got herself pregnant while dating me. So I did the right thing and married her. I think she really does doubt the wisdom of that decision now, but nonetheless, fast forward, we moved back to the States, and soon after we moved back, I have decided that I no longer want to be married, right? I can't live with someone, and I can't live without them. So within a very short period of time of pretty much dumping her without ever her getting her citizenship and securing it for my daughter and making all that, I move on. You know, I've got to move on. That's the level of selfish and self-centeredness that I do. Soon after that, I meet God's gift number two. Not long after that, she gets herself pregnant. So I marry her, and I'm all of 25 by now. A couple years after that, she gets pregnant with our second child. And by this time, drugs and alcohol are a very, very important part of my life. I'm studying to go get my college degree, but I'm partying pretty extreme. And at 6 months pregnant, I decided that was more important than taking care of my wife. And I left her. 3 months later, as she went into the hospital to have our child, the baby died when it was being born. I remember going to the hospital, and I walked into the hospital, and my mother-in-law is holding this fully developed baby and says, "Look at what you've done." And she didn't have to tell me that. I knew that. I believed that. I thought that. Who I was at the time, I knew the depths of my selfishness and self-centeredness, and I felt every bit of responsibility for that. I went on a prodigious bender. It was the spring break before I was to graduate college. And by the grace of my professors, did they give me a diploma. And so I get a degree in economics and finance. And I'm working $5 an hour as a construction worker because drugs and alcohol are so important. And I'm just scared to death to do anything more than that. And then, so that happened in April 13th, the baby died. And by July, I meet God gift number three, and by August, she's pregnant. Yeah, so I told her, I said, "All right, well, we should go get married." She said, "No thanks, I see how that works out for you. I'm not really interested in that." So she waited a while, and we've been together now almost 30 years. So, she is a saint, I can tell you that. I was having dinner last night, and we were talking about how we marry saints, and she's definitely one of those. And you know, the difference with her and the others was that I thought for the first time, if she ever says anything about my drinking, I'll stop. It never conceived to me that wasn't an option. I thought if she ever said anything about it, I'll stop drinking. And that day came and went. I tried. I did a 30-day trial and rewarded myself with massive amounts of alcohol because I was successful and proved I wasn't an alcoholic. And then I came into the rooms and I came in for her, because I really wanted to preserve the marriage. And like I said, I spent a year giving lip service to this deal. I wasn't buying into your God crap. I wasn't getting that stuff. That's not an option for me. And if you take God out of the steps, you can go through them pretty quick. You can go through them pretty quick. If you want, I'll give you my book and you can go through them while I'm talking. You'll be done then by the time I'm done. Which is what I did. And I spent 5 years out there. 5 years really trying to protect my solution. You took it away from me for a year. And I had to have that. I had to have my solution. I spent 5 years going to dinner, having a couple of drinks. And it was fun introducing alcohol back into the family. That took a little bit of skill to be able to explain to my wife that you guys were kind of weird. Abstinence, really? That's a little extreme, right? There's much better programs up there that let me rationally use alcohol. They got rational in the name. You know, it makes sense. So I couldn't show her that I was an alcoholic, so I'd have a couple of drinks at dinner, white knuckle it, she'd go to sleep, and I'd drink all night. And I did that for about 5 years. I don't sleep a lot anyhow. A couple hours sleep a night's enough. That with tons, and by the way, all of this time, I'm going to shrinks on and off all the time. Medicine, you name it, I've been prescribed bipolar. By the way, when I talk about medicines that I get from doctors, plenty of people need them. I have no opinion of whether you need that or not. I found by going through this, I didn't need them, is what I found. So please don't take anything I say along those lines to mean anything different than that. I started to go crazy, to be honest, as Bill did. It landed him on the rocks because I needed supplements to be able to get up and go to work the next day. Because I have to go to work the next day. That disqualifies me from being one of you. You guys don't go to work the next day. I get up and go to work the next day. So that was an important part, regardless of how much I stay up. And it all come to a head. One of the things that was difficult for me the first time around and why I couldn't really get, I got a soundtrack too, this is cool. Why I didn't get this is when I came in the first time, I got when you talked about being physically powerless over alcohol. I had the allergy, I knew that early on. When I start drinking, I can't stop. That made perfect sense to me when you explained that. When you talked about the mental obsession, I still had the power of when. I didn't have the power of if I was going to drink. My mental obsession, I was going to drink, but I still had the power of when I would pick up, which is pretty convenient. Because if you can pick up at the right times, when you got a ride home from the bar, when you can drink for the evening, when you're not driving kids around, all of these things means that you have some power. Right? And I had that the first time around. I lost that later on. And I lost it, I had a step one experience. One day I got up, I took my kids back to their mom's on Sunday after they were visiting with me. And I got up one Sunday and I was thirstier than ever. That mental obsession was on me. And I always picked up a six pack on the way home. But I thought, I had some more errands to run. I'll just get a little bit extra today and start a little bit earlier. Because I know how alcohol acts on my body. I've got control over this, right? So by the time I first come up with this idea that I'm going to pick it up earlier, and by the time I get on the road with my kids in the back with a TV, and of course, I put the seats down without seat belts so that they wouldn't hear me drinking. I made a decision to get a 12-pack of Tall Boys. Right? It went from a 6-pack to a 12-pack of Tall Boys real quick. 16 ounces instead of 12. Let's do this for real. 2 hours later, I hadn't dropped them off, and all the beer was gone. That's a lot of beer in a short period of time. I came up over a hill. There was nowhere to go, and I flipped a car with two kids in it. I watched them being taken out with their necks supported into an ambulance while I sat on the curb. I'd like to say that was the most miserable day of my life, but it wasn't. We went to the hospital, and they were being taken care of, and by God's grace, they had a few stitches before it was over. That was it. I was much worse for wear, but I wouldn't go inside because I damn sure didn't want anybody to know how drunk I was. And ultimately, they made me go inside because I'm limping and my shoulder's hanging down. And the doctor comes up after the cop had left, and he gave me a warning. My wife says I got a ticket. This story's better if I say I got a warning, right? And the doctor comes up, and he uses some choice words and says, you know, pretty much I was lower than whale shit. Excuse my language. Because I was twice over the legal limit, and I had cocaine and marijuana in my system, and that was a norm for the day. Step one experience isn't the fact that I realized that day that when I start drinking, I can't stop. It wasn't the fact that I have no control over the mental obsession, and whenever I want a drink, I have no control over when I'm going to pick that up, right? So I have a mind that says I must drink and a body that says I can't. The step one experience was that I wish I could stand up here today and say, wow, that was it. I'm done. I came into rooms of AA and I was happily ever after. No, I could not live with myself anymore. And with all of that knowledge, I drank. It was days. I had a few days of fear, and with good meds, I put it off for a couple of days. But then I started drinking because I can't live without my solution. I can't live with myself anymore with what I'm doing. And now it's no longer drinking to get drunk. It's drinking to get to oblivion so I don't have to face reality. A few days later, with the same daughter that was in the car, that's bandaged up now, I've taken so many pills that she has to hold the wheel because I fall asleep while driving when I went to get her. A couple of weeks after that, I was working in South America at the time, and I was staying in Argentina over the weekend. I was in Mendoza, Argentina, and I wanted to go and ride horses in the Andes Mountains, something I saw a long time ago, really wanted to do. And I went up there, and after we had done it that day of Saturday night, I went back to the room and had drank enough wine to be really, really drunk, and it's about 2 o'clock in the morning, and alcohol stopped working. That's the scariest day of my life. Not the accident. I've got a solution for the accident, and now the solution's gone. The mental and physical torture that I went through that night was beyond belief. I haven't got the words to describe it, no more than I got the words to describe the spiritual experience that I had as a result of these steps. I can't. They're not there. You have to experience it, and I pray everyone in this room has experienced both, more importantly, the latter. I think you got to have the former to get to the latter. That's my experience with a lot of people going through this deal. I somehow survived the night because I really wanted to kill myself, and it was no longer the frivolous kill myself, like she broke up with me, I'll kill myself, or they fired me, I'll teach them, I'll kill myself. It wasn't those frivolous thoughts that I always had. This was something I really wanted to do. I did not want to be here anymore. I came back from that, and I went back to my group. This is my third time in the rooms of AA. And no, this is the second time I came back. And I came back, and I stayed a year and a half this time. And I got serious, right? I got rid of my old sponsor and I went to his sponsor, right? Surely I'm going to now get the message that he got, which was the same message I got. And it really was, you know, just read the book and kind of do the steps and let me know if you want to talk. And that didn't work for me. And I'm sure there were better people talking about better program, and I love those guys. My first two sponsors were Tom and Jerry. It was just this past week that a sponsee pointed out that my sponsors were Tom and Jerry. All this time, I never put that together for some reason. They gave me what was given to them, which was insufficient for me. And I spent a year and a half, but I did more stuff. But after a year and a half, I couldn't take it anymore, and I went back. I only went out for a few months. I came back in the last time because I wanted to die. And when I came in the second time, I found a new drug. It was endorphins. I started running marathons, and that's a very helpful thing if you can do that. It works. It worked for me. It works for a year and a half instead of doing this program. And when I went back out the last time, I was just plain miserable, and I came back in the rooms because death was more appealing than life. And when I came back, I didn't think you guys had the solution. I'd proven twice before you don't have a solution. And I was in about 6 months, and I was talking to a friend of mine, an alcoholic friend of mine in Baltimore, and he says, you need to go and fire your sponsor and find another one that's got the message for you, because he doesn't, whatever it is, that's not the message for you. I said, I can't do that. He's a patriarch of the group. People are going to think a little less of me if I do such a thing, right? And, of course, my reputation is the most important thing in AA, right? What you think of me is really, really important to me. So I ultimately, this guy comes to my group, and everybody had a buzz about him. They were saying, you need to hear this guy on Friday night, speaker meeting. He's speaking this Friday. I said, all right, I'll go. I don't like it because he's talking some stuff that doesn't sound like it's in line with what I think, so I'll go straighten him out. I show up late in a meeting, and I get one of the folding metal chairs, and I bang it around in front of him to let him know who was boss while he spoke. And about 5 minutes after I sat down, I realized I'd found my sponsor, because he was a man with a real answer. He was talking about what's in this book. He was talking about being somebody like me, and I could tell he was no longer that person. And it just came out of him. So by the time the meeting closed, and we just finished holding hands, and I'm running to him. And I don't care who sees me, I don't care who knows, and I say in front of everybody, will you help me? And he did. And he took all of those experiences of that first step, and he brought it all together, and he showed me this hopeless condition that I have. And he showed me how really this last trip around was really about seeing the unmanageability of my life. And it's no longer about the circumstances that happen after I drink. It's about the internal condition that I've had. The first evidence we have is my mother taking me to drinks when I was 8 years old, right? And the issues that I had with people, you name it, the prey to misery and depression. He was able to show me all of that. And I said, oh, that's well and good. Right? But we still have this God problem. I don't believe in God. And he was like, I don't need you to believe in God. I'm like, well, that's the only way this works. I've read this. I know what the rest of the deal is. He says, I only need you to be willing to believe in God. All right. Sounds a little tricky, but all right. It sounds like brainwash. You're just getting the start of it. And he said, well, are you hopeless? Do you not see enough evidence here to see that you are absolutely hopeless, and in and of your own power, you're never going to be able to recover from this disease, and you're going to kill yourself? Yes. All right. Well, you're willing, right? All right. He says, well, you need that, and you need to lay aside your prejudice. I got a lot of prejudice about God, right? When I was 5 years old, my parents got divorced. We were part of a very conservative Baptist church in the South that my mom could no longer go to because she divorced my father. It didn't matter the fact that he was married to another woman when she divorced him. It didn't matter the fact that he had been married 7 times. We were just banded. And I thought, that's not a demonstration of a God I want to have anything to do with. I blamed God for the death of my baby. When I was in the Marine Corps, I had 30 of my Marine friends die in a helicopter crash, and I picked up their limbs and put them in body bags. And I said, if there's ever a God that is willing to do something like that to these good men, they're not con artists like me. These men went into for their country. I went in because I had nowhere else to go. These were good men. If he would do that to them, I want nothing to do with that God. These are just some of the prejudices that I knew. I had a ton that were deep down. And my sponsor said, you know, you got to lay that stuff aside. you got to put that stuff aside. He said, you can come back and get it later. We can give it all back to you. Just set it aside for now. And I think that's where they get the set-aside prayer. A lot of people ask about that. I think that's really where the set-aside prayer comes from, is set aside your prejudice so that we can have an experience with God. So we did that and went through We Agnostics. And We Agnostics is such a beautiful chapter. It provides a preponderance of evidence that there is a God. That's the beauty of it. We get out of the argument and look at the evidence. It's amazing what we can see. Then we got into having to do this leap of faith and make a decision to turn my will and life over to the care of God. And I still have spent a long time trying to define what God is and is not. And it talked about this simple keystone, that's a concept that I could buy into, right? It talked about how bad we are at being the actor trying to be the director, so we're just going to be an actor, and he's going to direct us. Okay, that's a simple concept. I can buy into that. He's the principal, and I'm going to be an agent of God. And he's the father, and I'm going to be a child of God. And those concepts worked for me, for someone that was... it was just illiterate when it comes to the spiritual world. And I think it's a simple concept is what we need. I overcomplicated it for so many years. So I take this leap of faith and make this decision. And now I need a game plan to execute on this decision. Something church could never give me is a real game plan. May have for you, did not work for me. And fortunately, we have a game plan. It's called 4 through 12. And I need to go on that. And the first part is in this 12 is I'm going to look, and I looked at what life by my will looked like. That's what 4 is all about. Living life by my will, how crappy it is, and what I've done to people is very evident. And seeing that makes me realize how, because I thought I had life by the tail. Because I'm controlling and manipulating everybody. But I'm just causing havoc and chaos in everyone's life, and I could see that. You know, it took me 2 months and 2 days to write my inventory. 2 months to procrastinate, 2 days to write. When I finished it, I was ready to take it to him. He had just had a baby, moving to a new house and starting a new job on Monday. I thought I got a week, He takes fifth steps pretty seriously. He said, grab a couple of Red Bulls, meet me at the new house, and we'll just sit on the floor and you do your fifth step. And I shared with him that I was drunk that day in the accident. That was my big thing, right? We all got those big things that we don't want to share, and I shared that with him. No one knew that other than the doctor, because nothing really happened to me. I had often wished that I had went to jail for that. I needed to pay a price for this. It was just weighing on me. He said, good, thank you. Now go say it to Kyle. Like, whoa, I ain't got to do it to two people. I have a covenant. I have a relationship with you. He said, person or persons, I want you to get free of this. Go talk to Kyle. He's ready for his fifth step too. And when I told it to Kyle, I got so free of that. This is where that building of faith comes from, right? First we build it with the sponsor, and now he's like, go to someone else. Trust God that much. Turn more over to God so you can see the power of God. Wow. A couple weeks later, I say it in a meeting. I talk about the accident. Oh my God, now 30 people have something against me. They have evidence. And then a couple of years later, I'm at the podium and I tell my story, and this guy gets up from the back and rushes up to me and says, will you sponsor me? I'm up for vehicle manslaughter and I need help. And you've got a story like mine. And that experience helped someone else. He carried the message behind the walls for 7 years. He came out about the pandemic, joined our group, and carried the message in our online group for a while. Incredible. Incredible. Because I submitted myself to this process. Is it time? Oh. Sorry. Okay. The book says in the fifth step that we may have had spiritual experience. We may have had certain spiritual beliefs, but now we have a spiritual experience, and it started then. That's why things were incredible. At the end of the seventh step, it says, God grant me strength as I go out from here to do your bidding. And that's right before we go into 8 and 9. I took that to mean literally that I am doing God's bidding by making amends. I am to fit myself to be a maximum service to God and the people about me. That starts with amends. I learn how to do that as a result of repairing the damage, not just saying I'm sorry, repairing the damage with the people that I've harmed. And I took that seriously. I had 153 people to make an amends to. And my sponsor didn't say, well, wait until you cross their path at the grocery store. He didn't say, wait until the funeral and wedding so you can ruin every family event for the next 20 years. He didn't say that. He said, we go out, because it says it numerous times. We go out from here. We don't wait. And thank God he didn't, because I'm still a skeptic about the power of God, and I needed to see evidence of God again and again and again. And that's what I got by going out, and each amends is an opportunity to witness a miracle. I start to have a spiritual experience, and now I'm seeing miracle after miracle after miracle. I'm going to read something from the big book. It says, the great fact is just this and nothing less. We have had deep and effective spiritual experiences which have revolutionized our whole attitude toward life, toward our fellows, and toward God's universe. The central fact of our lives today is the absolute certainty that our Creator has entered into our hearts and lives in a way which is indeed miraculous. I have a disease that needs a miracle. And I need to see this again and again and again. I sponsor about a dozen active people. I need to see the miracles in their lives. And I need to see the miracle as a result of doing amends. And I saw it again and again. I waited to the end to go to my second ex-wife. I hated this woman. She was the most evil person on the planet. Anybody that knows her says that we should have never been married, right? So I did not want to do the amends to her. And my sponsor had taught me that when you're doing amends, you ask three questions at the end of the amends. Once you've told them your stuff, you got to ask three questions. First, what else is there? Second, how did this impact you? And third, what do I got to do to make it right? That's repair the damage, right? I got to know what the damage is, and then what's the repair? I did not want to ask that of my ex-wife. I did not want to ask that. I thought for sure when I said, what else is there, she'd break out a scroll that would roll across the floor. Most of it would be financial. And I hated this woman. I hated this woman because of what I had done to her, not what she had done to me. I had to hate this woman because of what I had done to her. Because if I don't hate her, I have to take responsibility for what I did. So I go to her. And I say, what else is there? She tells me, and I say, what do I got to do to make it right? She says, there's two things that I want. First, I want pictures of our daughter that went to live with you in her high school. Whew, cool, that's cool. Went home, made an album, give it to her, that's great. She said, I want you to take flowers to our dead baby's grave. I went back to my sponsor, and I said, see, I told you I shouldn't do this amends. You see, she just wants to cause pain, and I knew that's what she wanted to do. He said, I don't know. I think you got to pray on that. That's when I knew I'd hired a quack as a sponsor. Yeah. So I went and prayed on it. And so I have to do it, right? And I go to the cemetery, which I had not gone to since the funeral. And I guess it's 15, 16 years now. And I have a card of the amends I need to make to my baby. And I do this, and this voice comes to me, says that I'm okay. I experienced God that day in a way that I left that cemetery. I bawled like a baby. I left that cemetery a changed man. I could no longer doubt the existence of God. I have been carrying this weight of my child's death with me for so long, and it's gone. The person I hated the most on this planet sent me to experience God. There's not a Hollywood script that can write something like that. Reparations may take innumerable forms. We don't know what's going to happen when we submit ourselves to this process. We just submit ourselves to this process and let it do its work. I spend a fair amount of time in doing prayer and meditation, 10 and 11. I, as I told you, I know how to operate in the material world. The 10 step says we've entered the spiritual world now. I don't know how to operate in that world. I'm not capable of operating in that world, and the very skills that I have honed so well in the material world do not work in the spiritual world. The gift of the big book that guy gave me was an act that proved that from the very beginning. And I've got to learn how to do that. That's what 10-11 is all about. It's taking my crap and turning it to God's work. It's that simple. My fear, my selfishness, dishonesty, all of that crap is turned into God's work. Resolutely turn our thoughts to someone else we can help. That's what we're doing again and again and again. That's being maximum service to God and the people about us. The big book says that we must sponsor and help other people. It says that that's a critical part. We asked Dr. Silkworth to endorse what it is that keeps alcoholics sober, and it's not the first 11 steps. The first 11 steps are preparing us for the solution to alcoholism, which is carrying this message to other alcoholics. And it says not only do we need to do that, but you're going to love it. It's one of the greatest things that you can possibly do. I learn more from sponsees than they do from me, I guarantee you, regularly. I got to listen to my own crap whenever I'm talking to them, right? And I can't be a critic. I can't be a hypocrite. You know, I only have a couple of minutes. What's happened as a result of this. You know, a few years ago, the other daughter got married, and I was able to toast my ex-wife at that wedding. That's something I'm incapable of. But I was able to do that for her. That's just one of the gifts that I've been given as a result of this. And the love I get to experience in this world that I was incapable of. This is a manual for teaching us how to love. If you break it down simply, we're learning how to love. And it helps us teach others how to love. I love the theme of this, pockets of enthusiasm. And I was so glad to be part of this. I need a miracle then. I need a miracle now. I need to continue to see miracles. And I've got to experience one today. Thank you for that.